Welcome to the debate. So, if you want to measure the weight of a stone, you just put it on a physical scale. The dial spins, it gives you a number, and, you know, that is just an objective fact.
Right. It's a clean binary measurement, heavy or light.
Exactly. And it's comforting, honestly, because we really like things to be easily categorized. But what happens when you try to measure a human being's standing with God?
Yeah, that is a whole different ballgame.
It is. When you step into the world of human belonging and religious communities, suddenly that scale is entirely subjective. We are looking at a landscape where measuring a person's worthiness creates a psychological environment that is just deeply murky.
It is the absolute definition of diagnostic muddy waters. And I mean, it's incredibly consequential for those actively navigating their faith.
Which brings us directly to the central question we are unpacking today. Does worthiness culture need to be uniquely defined as a systemic sociological issue? Or is it an unnecessary label that unfairly attacks religious organizations by just kind of rebranding individual trauma and perfectionism?
And before we dive in, we have to acknowledge our audience here. We know there are listeners who are absolutely convinced they know the church is true, and they hear a term like worthiness culture and think, here we go. This is just another way people are trying to destroy faith in a true religion.
Right. And on the flip side, we have questioning Mormons tuning in who are incredibly nervous about admitting their faith concerns, even to themselves. This material hits really close to home for both groups.
It really does. And looking at the recent literature and sociological analysis essays like 94% of them didn't want to leave, and the broader research on high demand religions like the LDS Church, I strongly argue the latter position.
That it's an unnecessary label.
Yes. Pathologizing the concept of worthiness is a reductive attack on an institution's right to uphold sacred standards. I'll be arguing that the genuine suffering some people experience is much better understood through existing, well-established frameworks like individual trauma and clinical perfectionism.
I see why you think that, but let me give you a different perspective. I will be arguing that worthiness culture is a distinct systemic architecture of conditional belonging. It requires a precise definition because it operates on a completely different level than generic religious trauma.
A different level? How, Doc?
Well, we are talking about a specific structural phenomenon. It's a virtue status system where belonging is not a birthright, but something entirely contingent on audited moral performance.
But audited moral performance makes it sound like a corporate tax review rather than, you know, a pastoral check-in.
But for many, that is exactly how it functions psychologically. Think about the actual mechanics of a worthiness interview. We are talking about a process that begins as early as age 8 for baptism.
Sure, but it's age-appropriated 8.
Even so, you go into a closed room, sitting across from a lay leader, often a man you just know from your neighborhood, and you are asked highly specific questions about your private behavior, your belief, your financial contributions.
Right.
This recurring event creates what the literature calls a surveillance architecture. It ties your most profound human needs, your eternal salvation, your familial belonging, your community survival, directly to behavioral compliance. Without naming this specific cultural mechanism, we simply cannot address how it makes human belonging dangerously transactional.
Look, I come at it from a different way. Creating a new sociological buzzword like worthiness culture just feels like a veiled attempt to dismantle an institution's fundamental right to ask its members to strive for something higher.
It's not about dismantling the right to have standards, though.
But it acts that way in practice. I completely acknowledge the reality of religious pain. But the symptoms described in the literature, the hypervigilance, the scrupulosity, the deep anxiety, we already have names for these.
You mean religious trauma syndrome?
Exactly. We have religious trauma syndrome, or RTS. We have the concept of socially prescribed perfectionism, which is when a person internalizes the belief that others demand absolute perfection from them in order to be loved.
But that's exactly the point. Where does that socially prescribed perfectionism come from, if not the culture itself?
It often comes from internal psychological inflexibility, not theology. As the source text brilliantly points out, standards exist to elevate people, not sort them. Blaming a generalized culture,
unfairly shifts the responsibility of maladaptive individual perfectionism onto the theology of the church itself.
I wouldn't say it unfairly shifts it.
I think it does. It completely ignores the empirical data showing that high religious standards often produce positive affect, deep commitment, and unparalleled community cohesion. I mean, millions of people thrive under these expectations.
The fact that many people thrive under a system doesn't mean the system itself lacks coercive structural elements. Let's look at how this systemic architecture actually impacts individual psychology. Have you ever looked into the design of a panopticon?
Jeremy Bentham's prison model, right? The circular design?
Exactly. The panopticon is a circular prison with a guard tower in the center. The genius and, well, the terror of the design is that it's backlit. The prisoners can never see if the guard is actually watching them at any given moment.
Okay, I see where you're going with this.
Right, because they might be watched at any time. They have to assume they are always being watched. They become their own guards.
And you are really comparing a bishop's interview to an 18th century prison?
I'm comparing the psychological mechanism. For a practicing member in a high-demand religion, the worthiness framework creates a permanent third presence in every intimate encounter and private thought. It creates a silent, involuntary bishop's interview that is constantly monitoring for compliance.
I think that's a bit extreme.
But it's what the research reflects. This isn't just someone having high personal standards. This fundamentally rewires the nervous system.
Rewires the nervous system? How so?
This is where polyvagal theory comes in. For those who might not know, polyvagal theory looks at how our autonomic nervous system subconsciously scans our environment for safety or danger, basically our fight or flight threat detection reflex.
Right, the vagus nerve.
Yes. When an institution holds the literal keys to eternal family unity, your brain doesn't perceive a worthiness interview as a friendly chat. It perceives the threat of social exclusion as a literal tiger in the bushes.
A tiger in the bushes.
Literally. Repeated exposure to high-stakes interviews trains the vagus nerve to stay in a state of hypervigilance. So to call this individual perfectionism misses the structural reality entirely. The hypervigilance isn't a flaw in the individual's brain. It is a feature of the system's design.
I'm sorry, but I just don't buy that. Let me tell you why. The panopticon analogy inherently implies malice. It implies an institution deliberately designed to oppress and control through fear.
It doesn't have to be deliberate malice to cause real structural harm, though.
But if this architecture is inherently traumatizing and designed to trigger a biological threat response, as you suggest, why do the vast majority of active members find deep sanctuary, meaning, and joy in temple recommend standards?
Because the system promises them ultimate safety if they comply. The joy is real, but it's entirely conditional.
But you are taking the experience of a vulnerable minority, those who are naturally prone to clinical scrupulosity, and mapping it onto the entire sociological structure.
I disagree that it's just a vulnerable minority.
If we look at the data on perfectionism and religious well-being, many Latter-day Saints with high personal standards experience lower anxiety, higher self-esteem, and greater life satisfaction than the general population. They don't feel like they are in a panopticon. They feel like they're in a community that genuinely cares about their spiritual growth.
I'm not denying their joy. But what happens when someone inevitably falls short? That is the true test of the system. Let's look at the mechanism of enforcement here, specifically the difference between shame and accountability.
Okay, let's talk about shame.
Brené Brown's research makes a crucial definitional distinction here. Guilt says, I did something bad, while shame says, I am bad.
Right, guilt is behavioral, shame is about identity.
Exactly. And a worthiness interview, structurally, does not just ask, what did you do? It asks, are you the kind of person who belongs here? It is an ontological assessment. It weighs your very state of being.
But wait, the questions in a recommend interview are almost entirely behavioral. Do you obey the word of wisdom? Do you pay tithing? Do you attend your meetings? They are action-based.
But the result of failing those behavioral questions is an identity shift. You are labeled unworthy. Look at the historical metaphors cited in the text that have been used to teach these standards to the youth.
Ah, the youth metaphors.
Yes. the chewed piece of gum, the board with nails driven into it, the licked pupcake. These metaphors don't just say you made a mistake. They locate the damage permanently inside the person.
Yeah, those are rough.
They communicate that you are fundamentally defective, used up, or ruined. And as the research shows, shame doesn't trigger true repentance or growth. It triggers hiding. It forces people to lie in their interviews just to maintain their social survival within the community.
That's a compelling argument, but have you considered the actual theological intent versus those outdated cultural artifacts?
Cultural artifacts that shape generations of people, though.
True. And I will concede, without hesitation, that specific past metaphors like the chewed gum or the pulled nails were deeply misguided. They were terrible analogies that caused real, lasting harm to people. The source text fully acknowledges that.
They weren't just analogies. They were the operational culture for decades.
But arguing that we must abandon or pathologize the very concept of worthiness because of bad 1990s youth group metaphors is just throwing the baby out with the bathwater.
I don't think it's just about the 90s, but go on.
The text emphasizes that the core theology, the atonement, is explicitly designed to enable people to become more than they currently are. It is an aspirational theology, not a punitive one. Let me offer a different analogy. Think about passing a bar exam or medical boards.
Okay.
Those are incredibly rigorous, high-stakes standards. People have literal panic attacks studying for them. If you fail the bar exam, it doesn't mean the American Bar Association hates you. It doesn't mean you are inherently a bad, defective person.
Right.
It simply means that the calling of practicing law is a sacred trust. It affects other people's lives, and it requires specific, verified preparation. The temple is viewed similarly. It is the highest spiritual trust in the faith. What you are labeling as toxic worthiness culture is simply the natural, inevitable friction of flawed human beings encountering divine expectations.
I appreciate the bar exam analogy. I really do. But I'm just not convinced by that line of reasoning because the stakes are entirely different.
Different how? A medical board is pretty high stakes.
Failing the bar exam means you have to find a different career or, you know, take the test again in 6 months. It doesn't threaten your eternal family structure.
But failing a temple interview doesn't mean you are permanently exiled either. Repentance is built into the system. You can try again.
But in the short term, failing that interview might mean you can't attend your own sibling's wedding or your own child's wedding. It carries the ontological weight of losing your core community and your eternal salvation. When the stakes are that high, the friction isn't just natural, it's existential. And this is exactly why naming worthiness culture is so critical.
Critical for who, exactly? Because to the devout listeners we talked about earlier, it usually seems critical only for people trying to tear the institution down.
No, the text argues it's a vital tool to help questioning members stay spiritually engaged.
Stay engaged by criticizing the culture?
Yes. We need to talk about the concept of spiritual maturity. Worthiness culture, by its very nature, infantilizes members. It forces adults to outsource their moral authority to a local leader. By giving members the vocabulary of worthiness culture, it allows them to separate the transactional human culture from the actual theology of grace.
I see the distinction you're making.
They can say the culture is demanding performance, but the theology offers unconditional love. Naming it is a mechanism for healing, not destruction. It gives those terrified, questioning members a way to breathe.
But you are assuming that the vocabulary of worthiness culture acts as a bridge to spiritual maturity, when in reality, it almost always acts as an exit ramp. Let's look at Will Storr's research in The Status Game, which is heavily referenced in the material.
The idea that all societies play games for social standing.
Exactly. Storr points out a fascinating and frankly uncomfortable truth about human beings. We all play status and virtue games. Every single human group, without exception, creates rules for who belongs and who doesn't.
True.
Singling out the LDS Church's worthiness standards as a unique trauma completely ignores that secular society enforces equally rigid, shame-based virtue games.
You're talking about modern political discourse.
I'm talking about cancel culture. I'm talking about the purity spirals in modern political movements, on college campuses,
on social media. They operate on the exact same mechanics of compliance, surveillance, and shunning. If you use the wrong vocabulary word on Twitter, you face an ontological assessment from the mob.
That's certainly a valid parallel.
You aren't just wrong, you are bad, you are exiled. So my pushback to you is this. Is inventing the term worthiness culture just a convenient psychological mechanism?
Convenient how?
Is it a way for individuals who simply want to step away from the rigor of covenant keeping to justify their exit? It allows them to blame a toxic culture without taking personal accountability for the fact that they just, well, don't want to live the standards anymore. It's much easier to say I survived a worthiness culture than to say I've decided I want to drink coffee and stop paying tithing.
Okay, that's a massive assumption. It assumes that the people leaving or the people hurting are simply looking for an easy way out, which directly contradicts the data we have.
I'm not saying all of them, but it is a factor.
But the research shows that many of those who suffer the deepest trauma within this system are actually the most devout. They are the ones who took the standards the most seriously. They didn't want an easy out. They were crushed by the weight of a system that equated their human fallibility with a lack of fundamental worth.
But again, that is scrupulosity. That is an individual misapplication of the theology.
But why do they misapply it? Yes, Will Storr says all societies play status games, but religious worthiness cultures attach those status games to the divine. That is the critical difference.
God does have standards, though.
Sure, but it's one thing to be canceled by Twitter. You can just log off. It's an entirely different universe to believe you are canceled by God. When a system tells a teenager that their normal, biological, developmental milestones make them unworthy of passing the sacrament or entering the temple, we aren't just talking about a normal societal status game.
You're talking about identity.
We are talking about the architecture of human identity. Giving them the language of worthiness culture validates their pain. It tells those secret questioners, you are not fundamentally broken. The scale you are being weighed on is calibrated to induce shame.
Look, I hear your deep concern for the individual, and I genuinely share it. The pain of feeling never enough is a profound tragedy, regardless of where it comes from. But the solution isn't to dismantle the vocabulary of worthiness.
What is the solution then?
The solution is better pastoral care and clinical support. When we weaponize a term like worthiness culture, we immediately put the institution and its faithful members on the defensive.
Maybe they need to be on the defensive to look at their shadow side.
No, because it takes a theological concept that inspires millions to serve the poor, to consecrate their time, to strive for self-mastery, and it reduces it to a mechanism of abuse. The text we are drawing from clearly highlights that true spiritual maturity is the ultimate goal, and true spiritual maturity involves accountability.
I agree with accountability.
Right. We can address religious trauma. We can address scrupulosity. We can train bishops and leaders to be far more compassionate, to understand the nervous system and to be trauma-informed. We can do all of that without destroying the very standards that elevate the faith community. We can rely on existing psychological frameworks rather than inventing a sociologically charged label that frames a religion's core practices as inherently abusive.
But addressing the psychology without addressing the sociology is like, I don't know, treating a burn patient while leaving him inside the burning building.
I think that's a pretty harsh metaphor.
But it fits the structural argument. As we look at the breadth of this discussion, my position remains that defining worthiness culture is an absolutely necessary step. We have to expose the structural mechanisms of conditional belonging. We have to understand how recurring moral audits and shame-based enforcement create an environment where performance overshadows authenticity.
Even if that performance leads to genuine community?
Yes, because naming this reality doesn't destroy faith. It actually allows individuals to reclaim their spiritual autonomy. It gives them the clarity to step out of the transactional mindset where God is basically an auditor tracking their mistakes and build a relationship with the divine that is based on true connection rather than the fear of exclusion.
And I maintain that singling out and weaponizing the term worthiness culture unfairly targets institutional standards that bring structure, meaning, and profound joy to millions.
Fair enough.
We must absolutely address genuine religious trauma, scrupulosity, and anxiety, but we should do so through the robust clinical and psychological frameworks we already possess.
By recognizing that the atonement and high moral standards are designed to elevate us, we can heal the individual without tearing down the very communal and theological structures that give people a profound sense of identity and purpose in a really chaotic world.
You know, despite our different frameworks and our very clear disagreement on the terminology, there are actually strong points of convergence here.
Definitely.
We both recognize deeply that the psychological pain of feeling never enough is a serious, prevalent issue within high-demand faiths. The suffering is real, and the stakes are incredibly high, whether you view it as a systemic flaw or an individual clinical struggle.
Absolutely. We also completely agree that true spiritual maturity is the ultimate healthy goal for any person of faith. We both want to see a state where an individual internalizes their moral compass, holds on to their own spiritual agency, and feels a genuine, authentic connection to the divine, rather than merely performing a checklist for an institution.
Yeah, exactly. The source material we've explored today offers deep, incredibly complex avenues for understanding the intersection of theology, psychology, and belonging. It leaves us with much to reflect on regarding how these dynamics operate, not just in institutions, but in our own spiritual journeys.
It certainly does. It forces us to ask what we are really measuring when we look at each other.
Exactly. At the start of the show, we talked about that objective, physical scale, the kind that gives you a clean, simple number. As we've seen today, human belonging is vastly more complicated. The question we leave you with is this: when we try to measure a person's worth, are we giving them a standard to help them grow, or are we just misreading a scale that was never actually designed to measure the human soul?